Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City, and I welcome you. Today, we begin with the latest on health and healing, including eating five a day can help keep the blues away, and a compound from hops aids cognitive function. Curcumin could help fight mesothelioma. Scientists claim menopause could be turned off or on in 20 years. How about we're doing it now? In fact, I'm one of the keynote speakers at a large group, thousands and thousands of scientists, in another 2 months on menopause. The only study that I'm aware of in the scientific literature that proves that you can actually reverse all menopausal symptoms. We did it. It was medically controlled, scientific in every aspect, and they're saying in 20 years we could do it. No, they're behind. We did this already. Researchers shed light on how breast implants may end up causing a rare form of lymphoma, and a lot more on health and healing. Then you're going to hear a discussion from Chris Hedges on the willful blindness, climate corporatism, and the underground revolt. It is Chris's contention that Bill McKibben and others are good corporate liberals, but they're not either aware or are aware and choosing, like the people at MSNBC, they play the Democratic game. And he says it's time that we recognize this. I had a discussion with Bill several years ago, and I gave him a suggestion on the air. If those of you who are listening remember where I said, I can certainly appreciate all your energy and efforts, but I don't see anything coming from them. And I gave him the reason why, and I thought, what would be a better approach? But once you step into that spotlight and you become a leader in a movement, not always is the best of choices made. So I believe that our 300,000 to 400,000 march to draw attention to global warming was important as a cathartic moment for those who've never protested. In the fact of the nearly 2,000 people from my own personal radio audience that went out with us, and you can see photographs of them up on my Facebook page, 95% had never marched for anything, against anything, in their lives. So for them, it was just a wonderful experience, being around people, seeing the posters, talking with people, networking, and just doing something that got them out of their comfort zone. That's important, but that's not what this was about. And hence, the march itself will be of no value. None, zero, zip, in my opinion. Unless you were one of those in the march who were networking to create coalitions that will begin the process of local political activism, then it was a very important day. We'll hear Chris Hedges give us his take on it. My guest in the second part of our program will be Professor Nick Collins. He is a professor from England. He'll be talking with us from the University of East Anglia in the United Kingdom by Skype. And we're going to talk about revisioning our interconnectedness with the earth and ourselves in a time of global social, political, and environmental crisis. I think this is very important that we have a discussion on the unselfish approach to understanding our crisis. And for those of you who are interested, I will be putting up over 5,000 different environmental groups' addresses and discussion of their cause so that you can have a large number to select from to join to participate based upon your interest. So we did a lot of networking. We probably had 400 different groups that we got cards and flyers from that we'll be working together with those people. And also, there was a really heated debate on Facebook on PBS Denver, Channel 12, because they had been playing Seeds of Death, because in just 2 weeks there's a referendum on voting for genetic engineering. The good news is the vast, vast majority of the people were extremely educated, knew how to respond to the those who didn't want any, and I'm willing to bet that most of those who were against it were front groups or front individuals paid for by the genetic engineering companies. Also, for all the people listening from Oregon, you have your referendum coming up also on labeling. Here's the difference between California that lost, Washington State that lost, and other states that have won: information, understanding the tactics the opposition uses, being able to get ahead of those tactics, articles, websites, documentaries. We have a lot. So please use Seeds of Death. Share it with everyone you can. If you can get it on public television, do so. Because in there, the leading voices of reason and science against GMO, period, give you their arguments. And that's what's causing a lot of people to wake up and realize, gee whiz, I didn't know this before. Now I know why I must vote for labeling of GMOs. I'm guesstimating that more than 180 million searches of the film have occurred just in the last 2 months. It's in every day it changes, but we're getting the message out. And the opposition is getting more shrill in its attacks. Let's begin our show. I'm working with a group of people every Tuesday evening, two groups because it's so packed, for 3 months to try to help people change their perspective of health, and in the process change their diet and exercise and stress management. And the idea was that many of them thought they had good diets because they were eating a couple servings of vegetables and a couple servings of fruit. But when I asked, is it organic? Well, they didn't know. Did they buy it in a health food store or from a farmer's market where it said no pesticides? Well, sometimes, but more often not. But they didn't eat a lot of red meat, but they were eating chicken and fish. And, well, do you eat shrimp? Yeah. Where do you get your shrimp? Where does it come from? Where's it grown? What is the shrimp fed? Because whatever the shrimp is fed, it's going to end up in your body. They didn't know. So I gave them a list of ingredients of what is fed to shrimp in Thailand and China, where probably 90% of the world's shrimp comes from at this moment, certainly in the United States. And they kind of went, ugh, didn't know that. So even those people who assume that they have a knowledge, it's really a superficial knowledge. This is from the University of Warwick in the United Kingdom. Quote, fruits and vegetable consumption could be as good for your mental as your physical health. The research conducted at the University of Warwick's Medical School, using data from the Health Survey for England, published in the British Medical Journal Open, focused on mental well-being and found that high and low mental well-being were consistently associated with an individual's fruit and vegetable consumption. 33% of respondents with high mental well-being ate 5 or more portions of fruit and vegetables a day, compared to the group that ate the less than 1 portion. Now, here is the takeaway message from this, that I'll try to make it as simple as possible. Your green vegetables, the full list, those are what provide chlorophyll, chelating. Taking out, chelation means taking out the aluminum, lead, mercury, nickel, other heavy metals that you do not want in your body. They're neurodisruptive. The more green you take out, the more green juices you have, the cleaner your blood, and hence the healthier your cells. your fruits, especially fresh, organic, that have not traveled a long distance, so there's a greater enzyme factor. That gives you phytonutrients that can help actually repair the DNA that has been damaged, even creating new ones. So if you have 5 servings and you get a 33% positive response of cognitive function, imagine what would happen if you had 10 servings or 20. Now, of course, the average person could not eat that many, but you can drink it. You could easily put 4 apples, including, and most importantly, the skin, into a juice, because if you juice 4 apples, you're going to get 1 glass of juice from that. We wouldn't eat 4 apples in a day. And if you, there's only so much kale or spinach or Swiss chard that you can eat, but if it's juiced, you'd just be flabbergasted. One whole giant bunch of kale comes down to about a teaspoon of juice because there's very little water in it. It's mainly fibers. But what is in the kale and in the greens are the phytonutrients, and that's what you want, and the chlorophyll. That's why sea vegetables are so important. They're giving us minerals from the ocean plus chlorophyll, and that's helping in the iodine, and that is helping our thyroid gland. And when you have a properly acting thyroid gland, you have a better metabolism, less likely to be sluggish and fatigued. And speaking of fatigue, if for those of you who sent me emails saying that you'd heard on the Howard Stern show some celebrity, I think it was Daryl Hall of Hall Notes, talk about Lyme's disease and how it's an epidemic, I will share, if time permits today, because we really have a very little time left in today's show for open calls, but I will give you, the whole audience, my holistic protocol for overcoming Lyme's disease. I've helped a lot of people with chronic fatigue syndrome and Lyme's disease get completely well, so I'll share that with you. Also, later next week, we intend to have on a person who is a father using a protocol is overcoming Alzheimer's. Major, major improvements. I'll have that person on, so those of you who want to know what can you do, we'll give you a protocol, and you'll have 2 people who have overcome advanced Alzheimer's tell their story. Let's continue on. So the takeaway message is the more fruits and vegetables you're consuming as eating, until it is reasonable, but not when it's excessive. Juicing or concentrates. For example, one of the most perfect foods in the world is tart cherries. Well, you can't get tart cherries most of the year, but you can get a tart cherry concentrate that wicks out about 50% of the water, so you're getting really concentrated, and some even give you more concentrate than that. So a tablespoon of tart cherry concentrate would be the equivalent of at least 2 servings of fruit right there. And you can do the same thing with pomegranate, with grapes. And then, of course, powders give you the greatest concentration. So one way or the other, or a combination of all the above, get your fruits and vegetables every day. From Oregon State University, there is a flavonoid found in hops and beer, and it's been shown in a new study to improve cognitive function in the laboratory. And it was published in Behavioral Brain Research. Scientists from the Linus Pauling Institute and College of Veterinary Medicine at Oregon State University. And so this, what we know in general is that flavonoids, those are the compounds found in plants that often give them their color. Hence, blueberries, dark chocolate, red wine. These are known to be rich in anti-inflammatory, anti-cancer, cardiovascular protective compounds. And these compounds, of which there are hundreds, if not thousands, of flavonoids. So the greater variety of fruits you eat, the more different types of flavonoids you're getting, the greater protection of your brain and the greater cognition. They were also shown to lower blood pressure and help with age-related deficits in memories. So the takeaway message, when you have your, by the way, one other vegetable actually has flavonoids, and such as quercetin, that is onions. So when you have your onions and garlic, or your blueberries, raspberries, strawberries, cherries, grapes, you're getting what can help your brain. And finally, curcumin can help fight mesothelioma. Now, I'm sure you've seen the ads on television at some point by law firms wanting to know if you're a victim, if you have it, in which case you can be a part of their class action lawsuits against manufacturers, like of asbestos. But they never tell you how to treat it, because orthodox medicine has no treatment that's ever shown to be beneficial against this malignant mesothelioma. It's a cancer of the lining of the lungs, and it's largely attributable to asbestos exposure. But here's what's good, and this was published in the current issue of Clinical Cancer Research. A scientist at the University Hospital Case Medical Center in Cleveland measured mesothelioma tumor expression, P1AS3, that's a protein inhibitor by activated biochemistry, which is correlated with survival, overall survival, meaning how long you're going to live. And then they introduced curcumin, and there was a statistically significant improvement. So you have a greater chance of living. In fact, it was substantial. 44% decreased chance of dying in the first year. That's substantial. And that's just with the amount they gave. How much I would suggest would be about four times that amount. I believe that we are really under-potentizing the body with curcuminoids. And unfortunately, most people are a little confused. They say, well, I take turmeric. Good. But that, on a scale of 1 to 100, is a 10. If you took curcuminoid, which is the active ingredient that has been purified and standardized to potency, it's about 70. If you then took a higher dose of that, maybe four times a day, then you're up to really doing the body a lot of good. So the turmeric is good, but there's hundreds of ingredients in turmeric powder that they use in curry dishes. Only one of those is the curcuminoid, and that has to be concentrated. So you don't want to use turmeric. You want to use the curcuminoids, not just curcumin, because the curcuminoids are much more potent than curcumin by itself. Let me compare it this way. Let's say that you want to get your vitamin C because you were feeling a little stressed. You felt like you might be coming down with a little bit of a cold. So someone suggested, okay, why don't you take some orange juice? You say, all right. But this glass is orange juice, and I'm getting 30 to 50 milligrams of vitamin C ascorbic acid in the orange juice naturally occurring, but there's no real enzymes in there because it's been pasteurized. So what is the likelihood of having one glass of orange juice going to stop the cold or flu? Very little. But what if I took 100 oranges, and I drank the juice of 100 oranges or ate 100 oranges? Well, then you couldn't do it. It's not physically possible, nor would it be prudent, nor would it be good for your teeth or gums or the acidity in your body. You'd end up with local acidosis. But what if I took 3,000 milligrams of vitamin C in the first part of today in buffered form and 3,000 later on and the largest amount before I went to bed? Then when you've done all that vitamin C, you've done the amount that's in 100 oranges. But you didn't have to eat the 100 oranges and all that acidity. You did it in vitamin C. It is the level of concentration of a nutrient that the body can absorb and help in effect super boost its natural immune response. That's why there's so much confusion on what's the best form of something and how often should you take it. I'm Gary Nall. We're going now to go directly into a discussion by Chris Hedges, because I like Chris, I'm not in alignment with a lot of his politics, especially some of his views, but boy, on this did he nail it. And let's just hear what he has to say. You could agree or disagree with him, and that's fine. That's the purpose of a healthy democracy. But he's saying things that others are not. A lot of the people who are at the head of the environmental movement are simply basking in the newfound celebrity status that they're holding instead of looking, are we actually changing anything?
The climate change rally in New York City over the weekend drew in at least 400,000 activists, representing the growing awareness of the planet's climate crisis. Yet with such a strong symbol of dissent, one of the main organizing groups of the march, the Climate Group, receives funding from corporations like BP, Goldman Sachs, and Dow Chemical, just some of the companies at the heart of what these activists are protesting. Furthermore, while the protest was historic in numbers, award-winning author and Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Chris Hedges argues that such mobilizations are ultimately ineffective, adding that the main groups that sponsored the march in Manhattan are designed to, quote, neutralize resistance. Well, I was earlier joined by Hedges, and I first asked him why 400,000 people marching in the streets of Manhattan pose no threat to the status quo.
First of all, because there was no agenda. Second of all, because the establishment was part of the march. Groups like Environmental Defense Fund support fracking, get money from oil giants such as BP. They stayed within the perimeters that were given to them by the New York City police, as opposed to the march that I was part of Monday morning, Flood Wall Street, where without permit, 4,000 people walked out into the streets and shut down the streets on Wall Street, sat down in the middle of the road. Until we begin to engage in acts of mass civil disobedience, especially given the fact that the power elites, in particular the Democratic Party, embrace the rhetoric of climate change, we're not going to make much of a difference. Obama talks about climate change as real and as something that he intends to deal with within his administration, and yet we have seen Obama massively expand drilling on public lands, offshore drilling, fracking, of course, not only approving the southern leg of the Keystone XL pipeline, which is designed to bring down tar sands, shale oil from the Alberta tar fields, but now they've used old existing pipeline to essentially make it possible to ship that oil without building the proposed northern section of the pipeline. We're already seeing that oil be deposited in the Gulf. So the rhetoric of the Democratic establishment in particular doesn't match the reality. The reality is that the political system is captive to the fossil fuel industry, big coal, big oil, big gas. And unless we begin to disrupt the system, they will continue this form of ecocide, destroying what's left of the planet at this point for short-term profit.
And you advocate, of course, direct action, civil disobedience, disrupting the UN. It sounds amazing in theory, but considering the protest zones that exist and how any direct confrontation seems to be met with militarized force, how is that viable? How can we go in there and disrupt these meetings and say, hey, we need real change?
Numbers. I mean, I covered the revolutions in Eastern Europe. When you pull 500,000-600,000 people out into the street, and the police will not use lethal force to quell that demonstration. And remember, I was in East Germany. That Stasi state under Erich Honecker was about as ruthless and brutal as they come. And when 80,000 people started marching in Leipzig in the fall of September 1989, and Honecker sent down elite paratroopers to fire on the crowd, they wouldn't do it. Honecker lasted another week in power. So I think that we have to begin to discredit the leadership through nonviolent acts of mass civil disobedience, because the system itself is seized up. It doesn't work. It is completely captive to corporate interests, and in particular, the fossil fuel industry. They write our laws. They own our courts. They control the systems of information, in particular the press. They use their money, in essence, to replace the vote. Their lobbyists write our legislation. And so the last mechanisms we have, if we are going to save ourselves as a species, is to disrupt the system. I'm not naive enough to tell you it's going to work, but appealing to the system is not going to work.
Right. And you've written, of course, politics is in the hands of the corporate state. Is anti-politics, real politics have gone underground, is what you're outlining now. How much does the notion of willful blindness play into the concept of political change?
Quite a bit, because in order, I think, to make a very cold and realistic assessment of systems or structures of power, it presents you with a very uncomfortable dilemma, and that is that because you can't appeal to the system to reform itself, that capacity has been taken from us, requires a much more direct confrontation with systems of power. So you see, people who care, Bill McKibben is a good example, care and have sacrificed, Bill, for decades over climate change, and yet he will not go up against, certainly in a confrontational way, the Democratic Party. I don't want to in any way take away anything from Bill, who I respect immensely. I just have a different read on the power structure, and I don't think appealing to those segments of the power structure, and I think, the Obama administration has proven that point, is going to work.
Yeah, and you've talked about how our agency has been taken away. Capitulating to the system is obviously not working. Of course, this is exemplified in your recent lawsuit against Obama over the NDAA,
right,
in which the government can detain anyone indefinitely if they're believed to be an associated force with terrorism. The Supreme Court, of course, denied you the case, Chris. Aside from the sham of the two-party system, even if the system worked perfectly, do you see the judicial branch as a problematic entity in itself?
Well, all of the three branches of government have become captive to corporate power, and we have certainly seen that within the courts that have refused to stand up for our most fundamental constitutional rights. You brought up Section 1021 of the National Defense Authorization Act, in which I did sue the president over it. This permits the military, overturning over 150 years of domestic law, to seize American citizens who are deemed to be members of al-Taliban, the Taliban, al-Qaeda, or something called associated forces, a very nebulous term, and hold them indefinitely, strip them of due process, hold them indefinitely in military facilities, including in our black sites overseas. Now, this is a clear violation of constitutional right, just as wholesale surveillance is a clear violation of our constitutional rights, and yet the courts will not intervene to protect those rights. And so when the lower court, the Southern District Court of New York, ruled in my favor and the Obama administration challenged it on an appeal, the Second Circuit, the appellate court right below the Supreme Court, rather than deal on the issue, which is kind of black and white in terms of constitutional rights to due process, they ruled that I didn't have standing. I didn't have a right to bring the case, which, when we appealed that decision, the Supreme Court upheld. So that is just a small example of how the courts have been used to essentially eviscerate our constitutional rights by judicial fiat.
Yeah, it just seems like they've become almost emotional blackmail now. The politics has devolved to now where people are just voting for president so they might pick a Supreme Court justice that might not be fascist. I feel like that's where we are politically right now, Chris. I just think that there's a big problem, even if the Supreme Court justices weren't voting for the corporate state. To have kind of this unelected body there is just problematic. What do you think?
Well, we vote for personalities. We don't even vote on issues. There's a complete continuity on all of the major structural issues, whether it's the failure to curb Wall Street, the failure to enact serious environmental reforms, the failure to curb our lust for imperial war. In fact, Obama's assault on civil liberties have been more egregious than under the Bush administration, and that's because it's the same system. It's a corporate system of power. We've undergone what John Ralston Saul calls correctly a corporate coup d'etat in slow motion. And so, to elect a Democrat in the hopes that they will put a replacement on the Supreme Court who will not come out of the lunatic fringe of the Republican Party, well, the whole court system has collapsed, especially since 9/11. On the most basic civil liberties. The appellate court, the Second Circuit, is not the Supreme Court, and yet they wouldn't, in essence, take the case on what even the New York Times in an editorial called a clear constitutional issue or a clear violation of a constitutional issue when they were writing about my NDAA case. So, the court system has collapsed. The press has been consolidated into the hands of a half dozen corporations. We just saw it with the vote on Israel. I mean, here you have Israel carrying out egregious war crimes, attacking a population that has no army, no navy, no air force, no drones, no command and control, no mechanized units, calling it a war, dropping heavy ordnance all over densely populated areas. I mean, I was a war correspondent for 20 years. That's kind of a textbook example of a war crime, and yet 100 senators in a kind of Stalinist-like plebiscite or wind-up dolls for AIPAC all vote that Israel has a right to defend itself. I think that's a kind of window into how bankrupt our system has become. They are just, and that was a vote for campaign contributions for the Israeli lobby, which has a lot of money, and it's a kind of internal collapse. We have the facade of a democratic state, but we no longer have a functioning democracy.
Right. The Israel vote was, I guess it was shocking to see even people like Elizabeth Warren kind of give carte blanche to Israel. But then again, when you're signed up for the Democratic Party, you're kind of signing up for that whole MO, Chris. Why is Israel such a third rail aside from this stronghold that AIPAC has of the political system? And why do we never hear about Israel's policy on ISIS and Syria?
Money. I mean, Bernie Sanders, who's not a Democrat, voted with the other 99 senators to in essence, cheerlead Israel's bombing of hospitals, homes, schools, apartment blocks, children playing soccer on a beach. And that's because the whole system has just been bought off. Our political system is a form of legalized bribery. And that's how it works. And if you can't get that huge infusion of cash, you don't stay in power. Or if you defy corporate interests, these very powerful forces will step in, and now, courtesy of the Supreme Court, they can do so not only in terms of unlimited spending, but they can do so anonymously. They will destroy you. And so, yes, across what's left of the political spectrum, which I would argue is very narrow at this point, you don't deviate. You don't deviate from the establishment policy. I mean, even Bernie Sanders, who is not a Democrat, has supported the attacks against ISIS, has supported the wars in the Middle East. And remember, I spent 7 years in the Middle East. I was the Middle East bureau chief for the New York Times. The fundamental problem in the Middle East is that we occupy the Middle East, and they don't want to be occupied. And 13 years of killing and maiming, and we beheaded far more people with drones than ISIS has ever begun to behead, creates these kind of radical, enraged entities such as ISIS, and that will not go away until we leave. Violence has created the problem, indiscriminate violence on the part of American imperialism, now spreading out far beyond Iraq and Afghanistan, and of course today into Syria. And it's not worked. It's not worked. And it isn't going to work. Nothing's going to work until we stop occupying that region. And in fact, we are only going to further inflame, further radicalize, further enrage a population that does not want us there. And yet that is not part of the debate. It's not part of the equation. Within the kind of corporate-controlled media, the question is, do we put boots on the ground? Do we send actual soldiers in to carry out intervention, or do we just bomb them? That seems to be the parameters of the debate. And as someone who spent as long as I did in the region, and I'm an Arabic speaker, much of my life in places like Iraq, this is just absurd. It is to ignore the reality of what we've done, to ignore the cultural factors that are there, and to be kind of willfully blind to the consequences of our own misguided intervention and these preemptive wars, which, of course, are under international law illegal.
Right. I mean, looking at the empire to fix the problem by bombing when it's been caused by the empire bombing, it's the cycle of lunacy, really. I mean, and talking about the corporate media and especially these beheading videos, Chris, I feel like they're acting as the PR arm of ISIS. They're using these videos to galvanize support for bombing the group. Meanwhile, the U.S. has this amazing coalition of the willing joining its recent bombing campaign, including Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, a state that just beheaded 19 people. I'm speechless at the hypocrisy, but I want to get your opinion on it.
Well, of course. I mean, I think last month Saudi Arabia beheaded 30 people. And you know, they were beheaded for things like sorcery, you know, petty theft. So, we don't anymore have any sense of what's happening within the region itself. It's all become kind of cartoonish. These images, and, you know, they are horrifying, of course, and criminal on the part of ISIS in terms of the beheading. That just, it gets sort of thrown at you repeatedly. And a very complex situation, which we have largely unraveled. We've destroyed Iraq, of course, as a unified country. The fact that we are now, after 13 years, tacitly allied with both Iran, Hezbollah, which is Shiite, acting as Hafez, as Bashar Assad's air force. I mean, you know, it's completely upended. We're actually working militarily on behalf of the very people that Dick Cheney and George Bush went into the Middle East to destroy. It just shows you the kind of chaos that blind military force has created within the region. But we don't deal in nuance. We don't deal in ambiguity. The coverage has deteriorated immensely. Most of the major newspapers no longer have correspondents there. They don't even make an effort. And the airwaves, it's right, it's all sensational garbage. And it's kind of frightening when you marry that kind of willful ignorance, even childlike ignorance about what's happening in the Middle East, with the capacity to deliver, you know, in tremendous amounts of industrial violence. It's a terrible.
And that's Chris Hedges. Let's now go by Skype over to the United Kingdom and speak with Dr. McCollins. And he is on the faculty of medicine and health science at University of East Anglia in the United Kingdom. We're going to talk about revisioning our interconnectedness with the earth and ourselves in a time of global social, political, and environmental crisis. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you, Gary. Great to be with you, too.
When we reflect upon the many ways our free market capitalist model is dividing humanity by class, religion, ethnicity, racial warfare, shredding the planet of its resources, we also need to consider the quality and state of consciousness of those who are at the helm of this global economic system, our politicians, the policy makers, the opinion leaders, the Bill O'Reillys, the Sean Hannitys, the Rachel Maddows, the heads of multinational banks and corporate executives, their blind belief in infinite growth dependent upon finite resources is not only, in my opinion, irrational, but fundamentally insane. The belief that military force serves a humanitarian means that was just discussed by Chris Hedges to achieve peace and stability is likewise, in my opinion, a psychological and spiritual disorientation. So please begin by sharing with us your views on how the quality of consciousness that now dominates the world is perhaps our greatest enemy for a sustainable future, and even the survival of our species. One little footnote, when we think of those on the right, when we think of the neocons and those who've had enormous power over our domestic and foreign policies, the militarization of our police and the abandonment of the poor and working middle class, the shutting down of our factories and taking people out of their homes when they couldn't pay their mortgage, creating student debt peonage and credit card and pay loan debts, we have on the other side the left, the corporatized left, or the ideological left that believes that, well, we don't want nuclear and possibly, and we don't want coal, but they also are still coming from a model of infinite, more sustainable growth. And I'm saying there is no infinite sustainable growth in either of these philosophical bases. They're not looking at what we should be doing to downsize everything to what the planet can actually sustain. Your thoughts, please.
Well, thank you, Gary. A great introduction there. Thank you. Well, I think I'd like to start by thinking about Herbert Marcuse, a great philosopher in the 1960s who highlighted and underscored the fact that we live very administered lives. And our sort of way of being embedded in these administrative lives that we're in economically, all of the ways that you've just described, has curtailed the liberties, our freedoms to act and to really make decisive breaking free from the economic structures that we're bound to. Now, that's a rather pessimistic view to start with, that, well, are we all trapped in this system? But I don't think we are. I think each of us has to look at, well, how can we respond to the conscious actions that we then sort of take forward in the world? And Professor Tim O'Riordan, who's a colleague of mine at the University of East Anglia, says that our current global crisis is really a crisis of greed and selfishness. And I fully agree with that. I think one of the problems that we've got to try and tackle is that whilst finite growth is a complete fantasy, because we've got an exponential growth of people on this planet, by 2050 we'll have 9 billion people. By 2100 we're predicted to have 12 billion people. The idea of finite growth is a complete fantasy when we think, well, how are we going to resource everybody to have enough food, water, and energy and live sustainably? We've got to totally rethink what it is that we're doing as human beings. And I've said doing, and I mean we've got that active verb. We've got to get ourselves engaged to really start to rethink how we're living. I was quite touched by Archbishop Desmond Tutu, who this week called for a sort of a spirit of the anti-apartheid movement, and how basically that sort of tackling these giants that are actually dominating the way that we're living our lives by boycotting things that are actually damaging our planet. We're really needing to tackle this greed and this anti-life approach to living. So I thank Desmond Tutu for calling on the spirit of human beings to join together as an irresistible force, to use his words, and to move towards something much more sustainable, much more conscious. So in that way, I think that the current global crisis that we're facing is in fact a spiritual crisis. I was very moved to read that one of the founders of the Occupy movement, Adam Bucco, who calls for a spiritual action to be part of a response to the situation we find ourselves in at this moment in time. The Occupy movement is about justice. It's calling for us to think very differently about what we're doing with our lives, rather than just being subsumed in a system that isn't working. So we've really got to try and rethink what we're doing. I like the fact that he's taken a spiritual, active approach to thinking about our deepest calling in life. What's our vocation? And I'm always touched by the fact that the word vocation comes from vocare, the Latin, to hear the voice within. It's an invitation to go deeper and an invitation to really live our passions and to co-create a better world. And from my thinking about that, I think there's something that we can do to facilitate that. We've got to start thinking at a micro level, at a grassroots level, what we're doing in our local communities, on our neighborhoods, as well as going on big marches, which I totally agree with, but also what we're doing in our homes, in our neighborhoods, in our communities. How are we doing things? How do I inspire a student that I'm working with? How do I believe in their potential? This could be a change maker. Everyone in the room that I'm teaching could be a change maker. I have to believe in that, and I have to live that sort of, if you wish, walk the talk, I think is the terminology. But one thing that I feel very strongly about is that we talk about consumption in this current situation, and clearly we're going to have to redress our consumer-based behaviors because exponentially the population in the world is increasing. But I think we can't really address consumption until we've considered our appetites. And this is something that's ringing in my head for some years. It was a Jungian analyst who first suggested to me something about the appetites, Dr. William Hughes, who's a very good friend of mine. And I thought, not only the appetites for what we eat, but our appetites for where we want to go on holiday, for the kinds of luxuries that we might want to buy. We can also think about appetites psychologically, socially, spiritually, Where are our appetites heading? What is it that we're actually desiring, and what is it that's fulfilling? And I believe that first word, appetite, begins with an A, leads on to the next word, which is awareness. Because the more we think about what drives our appetites and what drives our sense of working for the greater good, increases our awareness, and that enables us to have more capacity to change and to make decisions for change. And that leads on nicely to another A, very conveniently, about how then we're inspired to change our actions, to do something different, to co-create an improved future. But I think that really has to be underpinned by another A called altruism. And really, for us to move forward collectively and to reduce our appetites so that they're reasonable and sustainable, to develop awareness about the world that we live in, our interconnected world, and sharing with others, the actions that will co-create an improved future, and the altruism that really makes that happen, is potentially a useful way for us to start thinking about manageable change in our everyday lives, because it happens with each of us. But I also think that we have to be really aware that what we do in this world and the actions we take in it, we're also doing to ourselves. We know that if the population is increasing to such a level that I've just described, then collectively, if we act mindlessly, then that will have an impact back on ourselves. We can see that. Changing weather patterns, desertification, so we're losing arable land and getting increasing the acidification of the oceans. I mean, all of a sudden, our actions in the world, if they're not conscious, it comes back and revisits us. So what we do in the world, we do to ourselves. That would be a useful way to think about how we take our change forward, how we think about co-creating an improved future. If we think that the global crisis is a spiritual crisis, then we're really in a much better position to think, actually, the world on which we exist is our life support system. And in a way, when we think about that, it's a spiritual resource. It's something that we're connected to. We're not divorced or disconnected from. And so in a way, this consciousness revolution, the quality of consciousness that's needed, in my estimation, is that we've got to start to think about wholeness, that we're all in this together, that we rightly challenge the people that want to just take 1% of the wealth and create all manner of poverty for everybody else. But at the same time, we all have to look at our appetites and think about awareness, action, and altruism. So I, for my thoughts, that's a good starting point. I think there's more to go because...
I just have one more question for you, because what you just said shows that you're really aligning with the psychologist Carl Jung, who criticized modern civilization for its lack of understanding and respect for symbols and what's symbolic in our lives. And you're telling us that the current environmental and ecological crisis of climate change and global warming and acidification, I would add in the eradication of species, is actually symbolic of a deeper spiritual emergency that's being played out by our collective humanity. And if I understand you right, you're saying that the United States is bankrupt, your own government is bankrupt, and even look at Israel and its assault on Gaza, where nothing else, just 3,000 injured and over 500 dead children. And yet it was not condemned by those who are the most powerful, but the least powerful. So then you're telling us that we must move to a psychological and spiritual consciousness of interconnectedness. When our minds are so full of fear about the present and tomorrow, when our beliefs become so sclerosed that we are willing to sacrifice our dignity, our higher morals and values, and the consciousness behind our actions to appease psychopathic leaders and regressive systems endemic throughout our institutions, not only do we own our own psyches become fragmented, but so does all life and our treatment of nature, our relationship to our communities. So what you're telling us, if I'm understanding you, is we must regain and re-experience the sense of interconnectedness that can be found in everyday life, in the simple things we do, in what we boycott, in what we buy, in what we use, and how we use it, how it's disposed between our friends, neighbors, and members of our local communities. Is that what you've just told us?
Yes, indeed. Thank you for making the connection to Jung, because he is somebody who I've greatly admire and have studied. And in light of what you've just said, you talked about the bankruptcy of our economic systems are failing, our morals are being driven by ideologies which are immoral, and the term collateral damage is an insult to people's lives. I mean, this is not just collateral damage; this is people's lives. These are human beings. I think one of the people that really inspired me was Eric Newman, who was a Jungian analyst. And in the middle of the 20th century, he wrote words that gripped me when I first came across them. And he speaks about the modern psyche being bankrupt, that our modern consciousness is itself bankrupt. And the reason he made that statement is because we've been allied to a one-sided view of life, a very, if you wish, material, egocentric view of life, without a deeper connection to the psyche. I'm not, by the way, anti-ego, because we need an ego to function. But when it dominates, and when it's being dominated by shallow concerns and interests, that's when it becomes a problem. The psyche then is not related to, not understood for the richness of our human heritage and our spiritual heritage. And, we really become depleted in our humanity when we lose touch with that more soulful and deeper connection with life. We become divorced from our deeper nature.
Well, that brings us up to the end of it. Thank you very much, Dr. Mick Collins. He is the author of some very important works, including The Unselfish Spirit, Human Evolution in a Time of Global Crisis. His website is epiczoetic.co.uk. That's Zoetic. My takeaway message is from this gentleman that we have a choice. We can be pushed into the future by the current state of global decay, or we can be pulled into the future with a new vision and inspiration. And this is an opportunity to realign ourselves to a re-sacredized social, political, and ecological vision. And this vision can occur within different spheres of our daily lives and relationships, how we learn, our role in our own community, our family, and as citizens of the earth, the spiritual values of the democratic participation, our occupations, and others. So let's realign and go forward. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day. Let's say hello to you two right now, Luann Panessi. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. I know that you shared some of your feelings about this movie that you saw before, but I got just another email the other day, and this person said, I saw you and a group of people at the Lincoln Plaza, this was over a week ago, going to the movie about the owner of Esquire magazine. It was a very unusual film, and he says, in my opinion, it would only be interesting to people who remember the 60s and 70s and the role that Esquire magazine played in our lives. I'm a writer, and I wrote a lot of stories in the 60s and 70s, and I had even met you at a party in 1972. I later heard, and I never knew if it was true, that you were the highest-paid article writer, even more than Norman Mailer, for Esquire. I was always curious about that. And then after 30 years of writing hundreds of articles, suddenly there was no more. So my question for you is, what happened with that? And while we're on the subject, what did you think of the film?
I thought the film was brilliant. It showed a time when those of us who care about communicating at a higher level had that opportunity. Artists, explorers, adventurers, bohemians, all congregated. But the rule was that everyone had to contribute something that empowered us in our thought on a given evening. And that's why I so enjoy that time versus today, where we don't have that. That was a form that came and went, much like Gertrude Stein's great salons during the 1920s and 30s in France, where you would have had some of the greatest critical thinkers in the world, greatest writers in the world, essayists, and those who were in contempt of fascism and other states of being. So the movie's a must-see, in my opinion, for those who care about that. I don't know what everyone else was paid. I was told at one time that I was earning more than any other article writer in the United States. I don't know if it was true or not. But I had a long time working collaboration with the publisher that I would submit my my issues. He would then green light it or not. And I did 25 years of with just them. I was asked several times if I would leave and go to another publisher, and I said no. I believe in loyalty. And the reason I stopped submitting my articles, I'd published hundreds by that time, to the magazines because I found the internet to be far more viable. Now, I've published twice as number of articles over the internet that I have in magazines. Just this past 12 months, I published over 20, and these are major articles that are read by millions, if not tens of millions of people. And so the internet is the future. Not that I enjoy reading a magazine when I'm on an airplane. Otherwise, I never sit down to a magazine. I read the articles that go up on the internet. It's instantaneous. It would generally take a three-month lead time from the time I submitted an article to it was vetted and published. Now it can be a day or two. Still vetted, but it's quick, and you get to more people. So I'm writing more than I've ever written. It's just that it's a different venue that I'm seeking. I have no interest in publishing any Harper's or Atlantic or anything else. That's absolutely no interest to me. Hope that answers your question.
Sure.
Let's say hello to Eutrice Leed. No, Eutrice, she'll be here in a moment. In a moment, Eutrice Leed, who's coming to New York City, by the way, in a couple weeks. And we're going to have her doing some lectures here. So Eutrice is on her way, and she'll be with you in a moment.
Time marches on.